Evelyn Hooker died not quite a quarter century ago this month. Evelyn Hooker's death passed relatively unnoticed, but those of us looking for modern heroes and heroines should make note. Evelyn Hooker was a thoughtful, scientifically minded person who made a difference. She earned her PhD in clinical psychology in the 1930s, and after a series of interim appointments, began teaching at the University of California, Los Angeles. It was at UCLA that Dr. Hooker began studying gay men. At the time, science was pretty clear in its attitudes toward homosexuality. Physicians, psychiatrists, and psychologists agreed. Homosexuality was a mental disorder requiring treatment and a cure. Since virtually all the homosexuals whom professionals studied were either institutionalized or seeking help, it wasn't hard to prove that such people were disturbed and upset. Evelyn Hooker was the first professional to assemble a group of non-imprisoned, non-patient gay men and to match them with a group of heterosexuals with similar demographic characteristics. She then administered a group of standard psychological tests to each group and asked a panel of professionals kept in the dark as to the identities of the subjects to evaluate the results. Much to their surprise, they were unable to tell the homosexuals from the heterosexuals, and they rated the gay subjects high in personality development and emotional adjustment. Hooker's research, begun in the 1940s and continuing throughout the 1950s and 60s, shattered conventional wisdom. In 1967, she became chairwoman of the National Institute of Mental Health Task Force on Homosexuality. In 1969, NIMH published their findings in a report. And in 1973, the American Psychological Association deleted homosexuality from its diagnostic handbook. At about the same time, 1970, delegates to the Unitarian Universalist Association's annual General Assembly passed a resolution calling for an end to discrimination against homosexuals and bisexuals. That was subsequently expanded to include transgendered people. But 1970 and then 1984, General Assembly delegates passed another resolution affirming services of union for lesbians and gay men and asking congregations to support their clergy who performed such rites. I was at that General Assembly, 1984, held in Columbus, Ohio. I recall a conversation I had with an older straight male colleague immediately after the vote. "Are you going to do services of the union?" he asked me. "Sure." "Well, I won't," he said. I was surprised, as the whole issue was a fairly simple one for me. I'd spent most of the 1970s and early 80s in the San Francisco Bay Area. I attended seminary there, and seminaries, with their focus on ritual, interpersonal sensitivity, and care for the dispossessed, have probably always attracted a reasonably high percentage of gays. And I was also, from junior high on up, into theater. Theater, of course, like ministry, has its prima donnas, but it has all kinds of other people too, including the desperately shy, the marginalized, and of course, the artistic. But what binds theater people together, is my experience, is the remarkable emotional expansiveness and expressiveness of theater freaks. They're poetic and imaginative. While working late into the night, building a set or arranging the lights, conversations tend to be emotionally honest and forthright. One finds out what's on others' minds and what's in their hearts. Moreover, as Mel Brooks said of the theater in one of his movies, without Jews, gypsies, and homosexuals, there would be no theater. So it was through theater that I got to know plenty of gay people and lesbian women and worked closely with them and loved them dearly, hard-working, creative souls who were to those who knew them out of the closet. So for me, to hear a colleague in ministry choose not to do services of union made no sense at all. The mid-80s also saw the coming of AIDS and the beginning of TV evangelists, starting with Pat Robertson, using the homosexual threat to raise money and mobilize volunteers. The key issue for the religious right seems to be choice, which is ironic, isn't it? Regarding homosexuality, the religious right says choice is a good thing and should be exercised. People have a choice not to be gay. The scientific research suggests otherwise, that psychological, biological, and biochemical predispositions towards one or another sex are genetically linked and present from before birth. The thing is about the freedom to marry and the freedom to be oneself. Universalists especially, that part, and the fundamentalists, or the fairly rigid Calvinist kind of thinking, are very different. They're opposites. We try to be opening, they try to be restrictive. We're self-affirming, not self-condemning, following our heart, not the law, and forthright self-expression, not repression of feelings. Here's the thing. We may be different from our neighbors in lots of ways other than whom we partner with or marry. We may not believe the same as they do about gun control, abortion, the environment, healthcare policy, economic policy, capital punishment, you name it. But none of these differences seem to matter as much to the religious right. They don't seek to ostracize people from society and invalidate their rights to be who they are because they have a different view of the Second Amendment. This reveals a key difference between conservative evangelical and old universalist understanding, both of human fulfillment and, if you will, God's plan. Conservative evangelicals believe that while anyone can be saved, once you've been saved, you have to conform to a church-ordained social code, and naturally you will want to, won't you? We believe that salvation, that is, by which we mean, I mean, health, fulfillment, spiritual growth here on earth, and perhaps an epiphany about what might be beyond this earth, if, and the imagination's part of that. We believe that this has been granted already, and there's nothing holding people back from becoming fully themselves, except themselves. In other words, God's not going to ask me when I get to the pearly gates. I'm talking metaphorically. God is not going to ask me when I get to the pearly gates, why weren't you more like Harriet Tubman or Henry David Thoreau? The question is, why wasn't I more like Stephen Furr? And why weren't all of us more like our fully ourselves? That which we, you know, as my father said, be yourself. Everything else is already taken. Everybody else. The question is, why wasn't I more like myself? Our whole theology, then, is about learning to be authentically ourselves, learning to love ourselves, and about learning to share ourselves openly and with confidence. I'm not talking about narcissistic self-absorption. I'm talking about giving in to our inner creative and imaginative impulses, in particular when they lure us in the direction of mature, reciprocal love. It doesn't take a genius to recognize the wisdom of such an understanding. It's common sense. Learning to trust one's inner nature and to honestly begin sharing it is the heart of religious education and religious growth, at least as we practice it here or seek to. For many within the LGBTQ plus community, because of all the right-wing condemnation and fear of being shunned by their families, trusting one's inner nature and sharing it can be very threatening and very hard. So it is that many gays and lesbians stay in the closet. That is, they hide their affections. They repress, suppress, turning into repression of ultimately their feelings. And this is completely natural and understandable. All people, whatever their affectional preference, suppress some of their feelings. Everyone does this. Well, I can think of one exception. Almost everyone does this. Culture demands it. We repress our thoughts and our feelings for the sake of social tact and probity. It's healthy, however, to remain in touch with your repressed feelings, because the trouble is repression only works part way. Sooner or later, that which is repressed pops back up. Indeed, the more energy one puts into repressing their true feelings, the more counter-energy the psyche expends releasing it. Sigmund Freud, writing roughly a century ago, dubbed this inner dynamic the return of the repressed. What's been repressed cannot be abolished by repression. It tends rather to reappear, and in a distorted fashion as a form of compromise between the wish and the impulse to repress it. Freud, to be sure, considered repression a normal part of human development. Indeed, the analysis of dreams, literature, jokes, and Freudian slips illustrates the many ways that secret desires continue to find an outlet in perfectly well-adjusted individuals. When we go through trauma, however, or are thwarted in love, or for some reason remain fixated on earlier phases of development, the internal conflict between one's wishes and their repression can render a person pretty conflicted internally. Freud uses the example of a young woman who arrives at her sister's bedside moments after her sister had died. Looking up at her brother-in-law, the first thing that pops into this woman's head is, ah, now that she's out of the way, he can marry me. Acknowledging her fondness for her brother-in-law, however, especially at the moment of her sister's death, is unacceptable to her, and so she represses it and sinks into depression until she goes into therapy, recalls and integrates the fleeting repressed feelings, and begins to live her life again, no longer tormented by unconscious inner conflict. Depression, however self-defeating, is one way, and a very common way, that people cope unconsciously with deeply repressed longings. Another stratagem is what psychoanalysts call alternative sexual discharges. That's what's going on when you have closeted gay men who simultaneously vilify homosexuality. Former Senator Larry Craig and former Representative Mark Foley come immediately to mind. However, J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, 1924 through 72, is kind of the archetype of this type of behavior. As Anthony Summers points out in his book, Official and Confidential, J. Edgar Hoover's public attitude on homosexuality was normally at least condemnatory, often cruel. Despite smearing others as homosexual, including the Unitarian presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson, Hoover appears to have been gay himself. His life insurance policy named his FBI assistant Clyde Tolson as his beneficiary. In life, the two were virtually inseparable. Hoover and Tolson rode to work together, ate lunches together, traveled on official business together, went to social functions together, vacation together. They are buried side by side. Or consider the Reverend Ted Haggard, leader until 13 years ago of the million-strong National Association of Evangelicals. Haggard was forced out as senior pastor of the 14,000-member New Life Church in Colorado Springs after a former male escort alleged they had sex repeatedly and that Haggard used methamphetamines. In a statement read at the church the following Sunday, Haggard essentially confessed. Meanwhile, up until his denouement, he had been actively campaigning against marriage equality. It's a familiar pattern, this return of the repressed, wherein a natural enough impulse is repressed because of its incompatibility with certain ethical and aesthetic standards that one feels compelled to maintain. Keep this up long enough, and it can create a kind of an inner schizophrenia, where the repressed part of one's personality becomes walled off. It's still there inside, but so repressed that the individual doesn't even know it and ends up projecting it outward along with other negative or destructive forces it mingles with below consciousness on targets out there. Foreigners, Somalis, you name it. Now, a good therapist can help, but as long as we're only talking about dreams, jokes, and Freudian slips, none of this really matters very much. It gets serious, however, when we're talking about vociferous condemnation and even criminalization of those who bear our projections. Such people like Ted Haggard, do need therapy, but typically don't seek it until their increasingly anxious repression fails and they're exposed as hypocrites. The coming out process is often fraught with pain and anxiety. Many gays, lesbians, and bisexuals are rejected by their friends and families, or worse, in a way, patronized with the suggestion that they'll grow out of it. If your 20-year-old told you she wanted to be an astronomer, would you say she'll grow out of it? Or if he just meets a good school teacher or librarian, he'll be okay? No, that doesn't float. For a long time, the big issue in this whole debate was about freedom to marry. Of course, the issue of who one can and cannot marry has changed many times already. Anti-miscegenation laws passed to prohibit interracial marriage were, at one time or another, on the books in 47 of the 48 contiguous states. Out-of-caste marriage is still taboo in India. Polygamy is illegal in our country, but common practice elsewhere. My point is, whose society permits you to marry has never been etched in stone. Not by the authors of the Bible, or the Constitution, or anybody else. It's a matter of social convention, and has undergone numerous transformations over the centuries and from place to place. In America, the freedom to marry was universally denied homosexuals until Justice Kennedy's majority opinion 6 years ago. No longer may this liberty be denied, wrote the justice, for the majority in that historic decision. The transformation of Justice Kennedy's thinking on this subject is interesting. In dialogue with his clerks some years earlier, about 4 years before that opinion, Justice Kennedy is reported to have said that he didn't know any gay people, only to be corrected by his clerks when they pointed out the several former excellent clerks who had worked for him over the years and were and had been all along gay. It was then that Anthony Kennedy began to reframe the whole debate. Marriage equality has never been an issue of special privileges, but of equal rights, and of allowing, indeed encouraging, people to live not in fear of condemnation, but openly and honestly with themselves and with those whom they love. There is an incredible complexity and beauty in life, and people's lives are far more complex than who they happen to partner with or marry. In a world all too bereft of love and support, we should be encouraging any folk who are trying to be there for one another, not condemning them. But we know this. Unitarian Universalist congregations have been leaders in recognizing and affirming LGBTQ plus rights from the beginning. From the 50s, anyway, my colleague Ernie Pipes, now in his 90s, started doing gay marriages and lesbian marriages in 1955. And now it's the law of the land. Now, 2 days ago, October 11th, was National Coming Out Day. If you are friends with anyone or related to someone who you know is struggling with sexual identity issues or who recently came out, the following few days are a good time to let them know you admire them and you like who they are becoming. May we celebrate authenticity and interpersonal love wherever we find it and try to nurture it among us everywhere. Amen. And namaste.